Why is it, do you think, children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education?
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org. You're listening to Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. It's 6 o'clock, and tonight on the show, the four of us will be speaking with Jim Lowen. Jim is best known as the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, a hugely influential book that looks at 12 leading high school history texts, comparing what they prioritize, what they leave out, and what they just plain make up or repeat. He's recently written a follow-up, Teaching What Really Happened, and we'll discuss the new book. He's also the author of Sundown Towns, Lies Across America. He co-authored Mississippi Conflict and Change, which won an award for Best Southern Nonfiction, but was kept out of public school classrooms by the state of Mississippi, which specifically objected to a picture of a lynching scene. This led to a First Amendment lawsuit, Lowen et al. Versus Turnipseed et al. He also wrote The Mississippi Chinese, Between Black and White, Social Science in the Courtroom, and The Truth About Columbus. Also taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont, and he wrote the introduction to a book called White Men Challenging Racism. With all that said, Lowen's new book is called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History, a focused how-to guide for teachers with case studies and virtual lesson plans. The introduction is titled History as Weapon. We'll start there with Jim Lowen in just a few minutes.
Yeah. This is Teachers for Class War every Monday on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 6 to 7 p.m. We have James Lowen on the line, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me and many, many other books.
And most recently, Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History.
James, are you there and can you hear us?
I am there. I can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. Well, Ari, do you want to go with the first question?
I am ready to go.
All right.
So you're talking, both of us are teachers. Jessica is a middle school art teacher, and I'm a continuation school language arts and history teacher.
What do you teach?
I teach language arts and U.S. history.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So we've got quite a bunch of questions for you. But to start off, the first question that came to my mind was basically, what advice do you have for teachers that are struggling to teach radical history, but also make sure that their students are prepared to pass the standardized tests that they need to take?
Yeah, well, there's two different problems there. The first question is, what is the standardized test like? And I don't actually like the term standardized. Maybe we should substitute the word multiple choice. It's not exactly standard. It is biased in various ways. It treats members of some racial and ethnic groups differently than others for statistical reasons. But we don't need to go into that right now, except to say that it is biased against, in California, probably biased against Latinos and certainly biased against African Americans.
So let's say the high school exit exam.
Yeah.
Or a bubble test, a multiple choice.
And it is a multiple choice test in American history?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's two ways that teachers go to prepare students to take these exams. One is by teaching twigs, because that's what the test tests. By twig, I mean, we're not teaching the forest for the trees. We're not even teaching trees. We are, in fact, teaching multiple choice twigs, like when did the War of 1812 start or whatever. And if students are going to be tested on this, then we do want them to learn it. And in fact, I actually want them to learn it anyway. I mean, it's good to know that the Civil War occurred in, say, 1860 approximately, rather than, say, 1960. And if that's a twig, well, let's make the most of it. But one way to teach it, then, is to just drill them on twigs. And I find that doesn't usually work too well. Particularly, it doesn't work if your goal is to have them learn anything by the time they graduate. They may learn it by the time you take the state test, particularly if it's right quick. They certainly will learn it, most of them, if you test them on that unit, and then you move on to the next unit. Well, they may start forgetting it right away. So that's one way to do it. The better way, I think, is to teach what really happened, to use the title of my book, to get students involved in thinking about issues like, let's say, Columbus, starting from not quite the beginning, even better, starting from the beginning, issues about how did people first get to the Americas? There's a big debate there, so learn a little bit about that debate. Learn some stuff about it, and then you'll probably retain that one theory at least says it was across the Bering Strait. Another theory says it was by boat. One theory says it was 13,000 years ago. Another theory says it was 25 to 35.
Mm-hmm.
And the same for details of Columbus and what he did in 1492, and even more important in 1493, and so on. And if you do it that way with issues, then I think the twigs get retained, because students need to retain the twigs because they've gotten involved in the issues.
Mm-hmm. Yep, engagement gets them there.
Yeah.
So I think that contextualizing it, just contextualizing all of the different parts of American history, if that's the course that we're talking about, is clearly very important. And one of the things I noticed is that Lies My Teacher Told Me outlined a lot of what was wrong with textbooks. I have a lot of different questions. I'm just kind of struggling to figure out which one I even want to ask. But one that I'm wondering is, how do you teach the implications of slavery to generations now? What are the main things that you draw out? In our case, we have a lot of English language learners, a lot of Latinos, but
yep.
Even in a suburban white classroom that's hardly mixed at all, how what are the most important things to draw out of those lessons to teach students that slavery, number
That's
one,
really
in context,
question.
Is still happening and in other
yeah.
ways
it's
is
a really
relevant?
Good question, because, of course, some people think of slavery and teaching about slavery as kind of black history. And you need to teach it if you've got lots of African-American students. But you particularly mentioned Latino students, and for that matter, part of your listening area, depending on how big your radio station is, but part of your listening area probably has mostly Asian Americans, students from Cambodia maybe, or Hmong students, or wherever they're from, Filipinos, etc. Why do they need to know about slavery? Why does the next immigrant, for that matter, from, say, Poland, need to know about slavery?
Right.
And the key question, I mean, the key answer is because slavery is so important to us today. And so then you get into the question of how is it important? And I think that question should be asked for everything. In other words, why are we teaching about George Washington? Well, because he's important to us today. If he isn't, let's stop teaching about him.
Right.
So one of the things that I put in one of the illustrations I put in my book, Teaching What Really Happened, is the cover of U.S. News and World Report about 10 years ago, when, of course, the cover story was, quote, Jefferson and Sally, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And all of your listeners over the age of, say, 15, well, let's say 17, will probably remember that this is when the story about Sally Hemings broke. And it apparently is true. In fact, I think it was clearly true even before the DNA evidence that Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings were an item, shall we say, since we're on the radio. And they produced at least 6 children, one of whom was stillborn and 5 of whom survived. So this is making news 200 years later. Well, that's importance already in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that there's lots of other imports from even from that cover story once you start thinking about it. I mean, why does it say Jefferson and Sally? Mm-hmm. Why not Jefferson and Hemings? Well, of course, there's a reason for that. The reason for that is that the editors of U.S. News and World Report think that we, meaning you and I and all the listeners, will all recognize Jefferson and Sally quicker than we recognize Jefferson and Hemings. And they're probably right. So what's that saying? I mean, you can go to a downtown law firm today in Santa Cruz, well, tomorrow morning, and see who's getting first named and who's getting last named.
Mm-hmm.
And the people getting first named are not the people who are the partners. The people getting last named are not the people emptying the wastebaskets, you know?
Right.
So this is an up-down signifier, of course. And the biggest up-down in our history was freedom versus slavery, was the large-scale slave owners like Jefferson and the individual slave like Sally Hemings. So this is a terribly important era that determined a lot of the way that we still think in many ways in this country. So once you get students realizing that this has still got implications today, then they get more interested in it.
Mm-hmm. I would go even further to go into some of the territory that Tim Weiss goes into as well about this affects the wealth of people today, because what
Absolutely
you've accumulated and what you've been able to inherit is a direct result. Do you have another question?
Let me go off on a quick rant about that, if I might. slavery, the existence of slavery, helps explain why we have sundown towns. That was the subject of my last book.
Right.
A sundown town being, of course, a town that is all white on purpose. And Southern California, in fact, so was the Bay Area, from all of California, was full of sundown towns. At least 80% of the suburbs of Los Angeles, at least 75% of the suburbs of San Francisco, flatly did not allow black people to live in them as of the end of World War II. As a matter of fact, they didn't allow it until well after that, into the 1960s and even the 1970s, and even later in the case of some places. And many of them didn't allow what they called Orientals either, or Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Well, particularly in the case of black folks, where the prohibition lasted the longest, this just flatly kept African-Americans out of the post-World War II suburban housing boom. And the post-World War II suburban housing boom is where about half of family wealth that exists today originated.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't even have to go back to slavery. We can just look at 1947 to 1997 and the sundown towns all around us to explain why the wealth gap is so great in America by race.
So one of the things that we're dealing with is a generation of teachers who have not been trained and have not necessarily taken the initiative to think in the ways that you do. And so we have a lot of middle-class white women as teachers, I mean, statistically speaking, who haven't really done this race work themselves, who are given a conservative, a very, you know, biased, politically conservative text. And in a way, I mean, we're really hoping that the face of history, you know, the way that history is taught in our country will be changing. How are we to expect those people to really advance themselves before they can come into the classroom genuinely prepared to offer this information, you know, get into antagonism and then respectably fight off that antagonism?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'm trying to reach teacher education schools and change how they're teaching future teachers. And they are. I mean, a lot of teacher ed schools, for instance, use my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, and I think still more will use Teaching What Really Happened. If I were one of your listeners, I would honestly go out and buy one copy, not more, of my book, Teaching What Really Happened, and then I'd skim it myself, maybe read it intensively, take notes on it, but keep it nice. And then after I've read it and learned stuff from it, I would then go slap it upside the head of the idiot high school history teacher you had who didn't do a good job of teaching you about the, what's really going on with Columbus or about slavery or about whatever, and say, look, this book has 10 specific chapters that help you improve your teaching of 10 specific subjects at least, because that's who it's aimed at.
It's an excellent idea.
Especially the slapping upside the head of. Oh, okay. Another question that I had is I was teaching social studies a couple years ago to junior high school students. The parents were receptive to radical history or, you know, I mean, in fact, real history, but what seems to come across as radical history.
Yeah, I was going to contest that. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, we, you know, we're all coming from a...
I don't think there's anything, there should not be anything, and actually I don't even think there is anything radical about teaching slavery, for instance, as it was.
No, absolutely not. However, one of the things that I personally came up against, and I didn't come up against flack from parents about this, but I started to wonder at times, how do you teach 11-year-olds about the absolute severity of what Columbus and his ilk did and about slavery and just the psychological breakdown, the sexual abuse, the just savage slaughtering of various races of people without sort of being the equivalent of, you know, an R or above rated monster film? I mean, how,
well,
like, psychologically, that's heavy.
That is a problem. You're asking the age-appropriate question. What is age-appropriate?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some things that are not age-appropriate. Now, you said 11-year-olds. In my experience, 11-year-olds are around fifth grade.
Yes, well, I have sixth, seventh, and eighth, so some of mine are 11.
Okay, 11, even 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taught fifth grade twice, that is, two different days in two different school systems. but I taught heavy stuff. And let me just tell an anecdote about the first day, or in one of the school systems. It was in actually the Stamford, Connecticut public schools, which is a good one to pick on because they're very, very diverse. They're some of the richest families in America that send their kids to the Stamford public schools. Of course, many of them send their kids to private schools in Connecticut, but some do send them to the public schools. And then there's some poor Haitians, there's some poor African Americans, some poor white folks. You know, it's quite a diverse school system. The day I went to teach fifth grade, my assignment was to teach the first fifth grade class at like 7:40 in the morning or whatever ungodly hour it was, the next one at 8:30, the next one at 9:20 or whatever it was throughout the day until by the time the day was done, I had reached the entire fifth grade one section at a time. That's fine. So before we started, the assistant principal who had engaged me asked me, well, Jim, what are you going to do with these folks? And so I showed her some of the pictures, in fact, that are in my book, Teaching What Really Happened. For instance, a picture of a lynching, a picture of, actually one of the most shattering pictures is a little white boy, 5 years old, being pulled in a wagon by his old black male babysitter. And the little boy is whipping the babysitter and saying, "Get up, uncle." And this is it turns out to be an ad for cream of wheat. And the little coaster wagon says cream of wheat on it. And the whole scene is supposed to make the viewer feel warm and friendly inside, so he wants to go out and buy some breakfast cereal,
right.
Cream of Wheat, in 1914, which is when the ad came out. Now, this era, 1890 to 1940, is known by historians as the nadir of race relations, or nadir, some people say,
mm-hmm.
the low point of race relations in America, because racism was at its highest peak, even higher. Racism was higher than even in slavery time. And we don't realize this. It's pretty recent, 1890 to 1940. And this picture symbolizes it, as do some others in the book. Well, so I showed them, and I said, I showed these pictures to the assistant principal. And I said, well, I'm going to show them these pictures and so on. And she said, oh, Jim, do you have to? Well, of course, then I did have to. But I made sure that before I showed it, I said to the first class, some people tell me that fifth graders are not mature enough to handle the images I'm about to share with you. Well, I didn't tell them it was their assistant principal.
Right, of course.
You can imagine what happened next. What happened was they were twice as mature as you or me. They were perfectly mature. They
mm-hmm.
handled it just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to that one image that I've explained to the listeners, what I did with that image, after walking them through it and saying, what do you see here, and so on, and then explaining the use of the word uncle. Now, this is something your listeners will need. The black babysitter is, of course, not the little white kid's uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle was a term of quasi-respect that whites used for older and more senior African-Americans. We wouldn't want to say Mr. or Sir, because that would imply they were fully human. If they're female, we'd say aunt or auntie. We still have these terms today with Uncle Ben's rice and Aunt Jemima pancake flour and so on. And so we worked through all that. And then I said to them, now imagine that you are this little boy, 5-year-old, except 35 years have advanced. You're now 40 years old. And you're going through a trunk of stuff in your grandma's attic, and you come upon this photo. What's your reaction?
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what they would see. And the first comment by a little white boy sitting right in front of me was, quote, ooh, what was I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's only 4 words plus the word ooh, or the expression ooh, but I think he nailed it. And we went on from there. At the end of the day, the assistant principal said to me, well, how did it go? Because she was quite worried. And
mm-hmm.
I told her, that response, for instance, I said it went fine, and listen to this. And she said, quote, I knew it would. I knew they could handle it. Well, she didn't know they could handle it, but they could
right.
handle it.
Right.
And so I think that fifth graders can handle almost anything. I've got an email from a really good fifth grade teacher, I think he's really good, in rural Virginia, who said, and he has an overwhelmingly white class, he said, you know, your lynching picture is actually rather tame. I show a much more graphic one, and I do the following, and I do the following. And he told me several things he did. He said, my students come into my fifth grade social studies class knowing that social studies is boring.
Mm-hmm.
By October 1st, they don't think it's boring. They don't think my class is boring.
Mm-hmm.
And by December 1st, you see differences in them. You see that they no longer want the slash-em-up video games, for instance, that other kids want, and so on. He says, my only problem is with the sixth grade teacher, because they give her a problem because she just teaches from the book.
Mm-hmm. Which is good for them. I'm glad to hear that. So one of the questions, this is on a different note, but one of the questions that I had written down before our interview, and I noticed we only have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask it, are just about pacing calendars. In our district, we're in year 6, I believe, of program improvement, which means that they've cracked down in every possible way that they can, slash funding, and they've put our English and social studies teachers on a pacing calendar that's, it seems to be quite tough to keep up with, in the sense that we have so many English language learners and people who are dedicated to the content really want to do a good job,
yeah.
and we're just really busting through it. I'm wondering if you have known any teachers who have done a really good job of working with a politically conservative text that's mandated, and this is similar to Ariel's question, but on a calendar, actually, where we don't have a lot of time for things, or we don't feel like we have a lot of time.
That's a problem. I don't think that you can teach everything that's in the textbook. That if you try to teach everything in the textbook,
mm-hmm.
the textbooks have now grown to being an average of 1,152 pages. I know because I counted them. That is the high school history textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's ridiculous. They were too long in the first place, which was 15 years ago when I did the first book. They were 888 pages. Now they're 1,152. Makes no sense. Mm-hmm. You try to cover it, you can't do anything else. You can't engage students. You can't do nothing. I don't have an easy answer if you think you have to cover it. I have a serious answer, and that is it sounds to me like California needs to alter and improve how it tests history. There is nothing in the No Child Left Behind Act that requires California to use a multiple choice test. And there are states, Rhode Island has done a great job, that do not, and that test in much better ways. And we even have a model, and believe it or not, it's a model put out by ETS, that is the SAT folks.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the advanced placement test in what's called APUSH, that is the Advanced Placement U.S. History course. That test, and a lot of people are familiar with it, and a lot of teachers are familiar with it, that test has the DBQ, the document-based question. It has other essay questions. These essay questions ask students to think and to put together an essay, and then they are read by serious history teachers from all over the country who gather to read them all in May or June. So if ETS can do that on a national basis, then California, even with its enormous population, I know how big it is, can do that, and if you have a test like that, a test that asks students to think, asks them to write essays, maybe as a portfolio, maybe also asks them to give a talk, etc., has different ways of testing, well, then you suddenly have a test worth teaching to, because what you're talking about is teachers have to teach to the test.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have a test worth teaching to.
So how do we as teachers go about affecting that change? I mean, what I'm really looking for are stories of...
You know, I think you got to agitate in your district,
mm-hmm.
and then get the district to agitate. In many cases, the well, some states, there isn't even a statewide test in history, which turns out to be a disaster also, because then it's just ignored pretty much, and you test the 3 R's instead,
mm-hmm.
and you teach the 3 R's instead. But in no state is there a mandate for a multiple choice test. And in no state is there any real sentiment for it. This was just what the legislators did because they had to do something quick and dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the testing industry has made a fortune off of it and has lobbied the legislature and so on. But it's not as if you're going up against a popular opponent. The standardized, so-called standardized tests are an unpopular opponent. And so I think that they are feet of clay and you can change them.
Well, I hope that is the case. We've definitely been working with our union on a number of fronts, not necessarily with any great success, but that's what we're looking forward to and hoping that we can move towards.
Okay, well, I can't tell you about the political situation, but I can tell that if students are going to be interested in history, it's because teachers maybe read my book, Teaching What Really Happened. In any case, it's when teachers do teach what really happened.
Well, we want to thank you very much for coming on, and I know you need to run, so if there's anything else you wanted to throw into the mix, you're welcome to do that now, but I do want to give you the opportunity to get off the air if you need to run.
No, I've enjoyed talking with you, and thanks for having me.
Okay, well, thank you very much, James.
Okay.
This is Teachers for Class War, every Monday, 6 to 7, on freakradio.org and 101.1 FM.
Today, the color line is the power line, is the poverty line.